Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies program titled Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. Our speaker is University of Florida Assistant Professor of African American History, Ibram X. Kendi. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Professor of African American Studies and History, Linda Haywood.
It's really my pleasure to be here once again introducing Ibram X. Kendi, who is a New York Times best-selling author and award-winning historian who is at the University of Florida. We are especially excited that he's coming to us after his outstanding second a book, Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racial Ideas in America, which in 2016 won the National Book Award for Nonfiction and was also named a finalist for the 2016 National Book Critics Circle Award. The book is described as engaging, engrossing, and relentless by the Washington Post. It has also been named in the list of best books for 2016, in lists that range from Boston Globe, Kirkus, The Root, Chicago Review of Books, and BuzzFeed. Stamped has also was also nominated for the NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Literary Work in Nonfiction. Professor Kendi is also the author of another award-winning book, The Black Campus Movement, Black Students and the Racial Reconstruction of Higher Education, 1965-72. He's not only confined himself to books, but he has published 14 essays in journals and as book chapters, as well as many op-ed pieces in a number of publications, ranging from the New York Times, Salon, Black Perspectives, New York Daily News, the Huffington Post, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and Truthout. He has also received research fellowships, grants, and visiting appointments from a variety of university foundations, professional associations, and libraries, including the American Historical Association, the Library of Congress, National Academy of Education, the Spencer Foundation, Lyndon B. Johnson Library and Museum, Rutgers Center for Historical Analysis, Brown University, Princeton University, and Duke University. Professor Kendi is a graduate of Florida A&M University and Temple University. In any event, I'm just very excited to purchase the book. As you see it here, I've got it already, his autograph. So I'm waiting to hear what really the book is about and to sort of learn new insights, as I'm sure you all are. So again, once again, welcome, and now I'll call on Professor Kendi.
Thank you so much, Linda, for that introduction. I am I'm actually really honored, and you know, to be here. I've traveled, you know, all over the country speaking about this book, but this is the first time I've spoken about it in Boston, and I'm actually quite delighted to be speaking about it here in Boston, here at Boston University, because much of my narrative of racist ideas actually runs through this very city. And so the actual narrative, and it really chronicles the entire history of racist ideas from their origins in 15th century Portugal, literally to the present. And the book is organized around five major characters. And each of these major characters are people who really were at the forefront of these racial debates. The first major character in the first section is Cotton Mather. Anybody heard of Cotton Mather? So those of you who may or may not know, he was not only a famed theologian and pastor at the North Church of Boston. He really came from the first great intellectual dynasty. But he was also a critically important theologian of race. And many of his biographers and apologists do not mention that side of Cotton Mather. But I certainly describe his role in the history of racist ideas in this book. And then the next major character is Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, wasn't necessarily a resident of Boston, but from what I understand, Bostonians didn't like Jefferson too much. You know, I don't know if they hated Jefferson as much as they hate Donald Trump, but it may be close. So, and then the third major character is William Lloyd Garrison. And I'm going to speak a little bit more about him later because he's really the subject of my talk. The fourth major character is W.E.B. Du Bois, who, of course, said he was in Harvard, but not of Harvard, when he came here to Boston, to Cambridge, as a student, and eventually became the first African-American to earn a doctorate from Harvard. And then the last major character of the book, and her sort of section covers the last 50 years, is Angela Davis. And Angela Davis, of course, who's not only a daughter of Dynamite Hill in Birmingham, but also the daughter of two Dynamite parents. She, of course, went to Brandeis for college. And so, you know, a lot of these characters and a lot of, therefore, the narrative really truly runs through this city. And so, again, it's truly an honor to be here. And really, I don't really chronicle in this book through these characters, and these characters really serve as this window to this larger debate about race in America. And I don't really just sort of chronicle a sort of two-way debate between, let's say, racist ideas and non-racist ideas. I actually chronicle a three-way debate of two kinds of racist ideas, constantly sort of debating anti-racist ideas. And so I actually chronicle two kinds of racist ideas. The first kind is what I call a segregationist idea. And segregationist ideas typically have stated that black people are inferior by nature and therefore permanently inferior. And typically segregationists, when they look out at racial inequities and disparities in our society, they principally blame black people and their inferiorities. And then you have anti-racist. And typically, anti-racist ideas have stated that the racial groups are equal. It's a very simple idea, but actually when it plays out, what they ultimately say is that when they see racial disparities in this country, they don't see anything wrong with black people. They see racial discrimination. And anti-racist ideas have typically stated that not only black people are equal by nature, but they're equal by nurture. Not only are the racial groups created equal, but they are equal. And this becomes important when you think about my third sort of category, which is assimilationist ideas. And so typically assimilationist ideas say that the racial groups have been created equal, but black people became inferior due to their inferior environment. And whether that inferior environment is poverty, segregation, or slavery, whether that inferior environment is barbaric Africa or pathological African-American culture, but something made them inferior, assimilationists have long argued. But because they are originally equal, we have the capacity to civilize and develop them if we put them in a different and better environment. And so typically assimilationists have simultaneously said that racial inequities in our society are both the result of racial discrimination and black inferiority. But we can heal the black inferiority, and simultaneously they have challenged, of course, racial discrimination. And I say these categories because I really want to talk to you today about assimilationist ideas, specifically through the life of the ideas of William Lloyd Garrison. And William Lloyd Garrison, as many of you know, came to Boston and became an editor of The Liberator. And The Liberator, of course, was really the mouthpiece of the white abolitionist movement, the most important abolitionist periodical. But then he, of course, went on to be centrally involved in the founding of many anti-slavery societies. And I also wanted to speak about him because he probably was the most critical assimilationist thinker in American history. He probably popularized nearly every major assimilationist idea, aside from Thomas Jefferson's popularization of the idea of the racial groups being created equal. Garrison's most instrumentally passionate anti-slavery ideas, drawing Americans to the cause of abolition and even civil rights, were typically not anti-racist ideas. He popularized the assimilationist idea that slavery, or we can think of racial discrimination more broadly, had imbruted Black people. This oppression had made their cultures, their psychologies, and even their behaviors inferior. And I think there was no better time in which he expressed this idea than when he wrote the preface to Frederick Douglass's Slave Narrative, which of course was published in 1845. And of course, Garrison, of course, published this narrative. And he stated in this preface that slavery had, quote, degraded Black people in the scale of humanity. Nothing has been left undone to cripple their intellects, darken their minds, debase their moral nature, obliterate all traces of their relationship to mankind. So essentially, Garrison, through starting at different places and taking a different conceptual route, he kept arriving at the same racist place as his enslaving enemies, Black inferiority. But if you let Garrison tell it, in Douglass's preface, abolitionists like him had, quote, wholly confounded complexional differences. So like every other thinker who expressed that Black people were inferior, of course, he did not believe his ideas were in any way racist. This theory about slavery literally making Black people inferior reigned for a century after the end of slavery through the work of pioneering historians like George Washington Williams, W.E.B. Du Bois, to even a young John Hope Franklin, and even Stanley Elkins. Even sociologist E. Franklin Frazier once wrote, "Slavery was a cruel and barbaric system that annihilated the Negro as a person," end quote. These well-meaning scholars wrote this idea into reality to counteract the Jim Crow historians who were claiming that slavery was a civilizing force. So, you know, after the end of slavery, you had Jim Crow historians saying that slavery literally civilized Black people, right? They arrived from barbaric Africa, not knowing anything, and they literally were civilized by slavery. So these historians counteracted that. No, slavery debased them. It imbruted them. Slavery was that, of course, horrible. And we should know that it is one anti-racist thing to say discriminators treated Black people like barbarians. It is yet another racist thing to say that discrimination actually transformed Black people into barbarians. But the historically racist theory has lived on, and it still is with us in the ever-popular theory of post-traumatic slave syndrome. To Garrison, the enslaver was not the civilizer. The abolitionist, like him, was the civilizer. Like the slaveholders or segregationists he despised, Garrison standardized the ways of life of white Americans, judged Black people from those standards, and rendered Black people inferior. But unlike slaveholders, unlike segregationists, he believed Black people were capable of being developed, capable of being civilized. He did not believe the anti-racist idea that enslaved and free Blacks were already civilized, were already equal, despite the different ways they looked and loved and spoke and philosophized and sung and worshiped. On Saturday, January 1st, 1831, he published the first issue of The Liberator, the organ that, of course, relaunched the abolitionist movement among white Americans. In his first editorial manifesto, to the public. Garrison made a, quote, full and unequivocal recant of the popular but pernicious doctrine of gradual abolition. And so as a quick aside, I mean, Garrison would become famous and would be revered, rightfully so, as the first major articulator of this notion of immediate emancipation, right? Before him, there were those in the racial reform community who were considered progressive, who were touting gradual abolition, that black people literally need to be prepared for freedom. We can't free them all at once. But Garrison rejected that idea in a very anti-racist fashion and called for immediate emancipation. And for the rest of his abolitionist life, he never retreated on that idea, even though it made the vast majority of white Americans even uncomfortable. He rebuked any talk of gradual emancipation, of preparing society and preparing Africans for emancipation one day. But he did make clear his preference for gradual equality. Retreating on immediate equality and outlining a process of civilizing black people to be equal one day. So he believed black people were ready for freedom because they were human, but he did not believe that they were equal. Garrison and his band of assimilationists would stridently fight for gradual equality, calling anti-racists who fought for immediate equality impractical and crazy, just as slaveholders and segregationists called him crazy for demanding immediate emancipation. Black subscribers were the early lifeblood of the liberator, and Garrison spoke to black people in his newspaper and in speeches in New York and Philadelphia. He pressed free blacks to challenge, quote, every law which infringes on your rights as free native citizens to respect yourself if you desire the respect of others. They had acquired and would continue to acquire, quote, the esteem, confidence, and patronage, Garrison is writing, of the whites in proportion to your increase in knowledge and moral improvement. Garrison urged blacks to acquire money too, because he said, quote, money begets influence and influence respectability. Garrison believed that the nearer blacks approached the whites in their habits, the better they were, according to an early biographer. They always seemed to him to be a social problem, this biographer said, rather than simply people. When blacks were seen as a social problem, the solution to racist ideas seemed simple. As blacks rose, so would white opinions. When blacks were seen as simply people, a collection of imperfect individuals equal to the imperfect collection of individuals with white skins, their blacks' imperfect behavior became irrelevant. And discrimination was the social problem, the cause of the racial disparities between two equal collections of individuals. But Garrison, of course, continued to see black people as a problem as opposed to a people. In emphasizing black self-improvement to ward off racism, Garrison was reflecting the views of elite black activists who invited him to their cities and subscribed to his newspaper. Black activists, in many cases, saw each other as social problems that needed to be fixed. Quote, if we ever expect to see the influence of prejudice decrease and ourselves respected, it must be by the blessings of an enlightened education, resolved the attendees of Philadelphia's second annual convention for the improvement of free people of color. And so this strategy of black people uplifting themselves, what Garrison urged black people to do, in the text I call it uplift-suasion. Uplift-suasion. And essentially this strategy is based on this idea that as black people uplift themselves and they start defying the stereotypes that renders black people inferior, so too will they persuade away the racist ideas of whites. And this is a very popular theory. I'm sure most I've been taught it indirectly, if not directly, from my parents. Many black people have been taught this type of theory, even still today. Watch how you act in front of white people, because if you act in a stereotypical manner, you're only reinforcing their ideas. In contrast, if you act as an upright person, then you'll persuade away their ideas, right? So this idea of what I call uplift suasion was an idea that Garrison held, and many of the black elites who support him also held. And I write about in Stamp from the Beginning how this strategy, probably the most popular strategy that black people have used and white reformers have used to undermine racist ideas in American history, is actually a strategy based on a racist idea. It's actually based on this idea that black people are partially responsible for the ideas, the racist ideas that whites may have about them. And to suggest that black people are responsible, have any sort of responsibility in the way people see them, is to suggest that there's some truth in notions of black inferiority. And to suggest there's some notions of truth in black inferiority is to hold a racist idea. And not only is this strategy that Garrison and many others put forth based on a racist idea, it's actually an impossible strategy to execute. Because black people, then as they are now, are imperfect. And trying for any person to always act in an upright manner is trying to not be human. And so this notion that black people could simply do that is essentially trying to render black people superhuman. But what's ironic is that typically when black people are able to do this, they're typically rendered extraordinary. And so I not only chronicle this history of uplift suasion, but I also chronicle this history of the extraordinary Negro, an idea that allows people to see black people defying stereotypes. And instead of saying, you know what, black people are not like that, instead they say that that person is extraordinary, not like those ordinary, inferior black people. And we, of course, got a good sense of what it means and the impact of an extraordinary Negro in watching Barack Obama in the White House over the last 8 years, right? You had people who just cast him aside as extraordinary, as opposed to him being a representation of racial equality. And so William Goy Garrison and so many other abolitionists he inspired chose not to engage in the same way they did against slavery, against racial discrimination. And this becomes really apparent during the early years of Reconstruction, when Garrison suggests that black people are not ready for their civil rights. Garrison suggests black people are not ready to vote. Partly he's defending Lincoln, who's slow on the matter. But so Garrison failed to realize that really it was his genius as one of the leaders of the abolitionist movement that had transformed abolitionism from this complex, multi-issued political project with unclear battle lines and objectives into a simple, single-issue moral project. Slavery was evil, and those racists justifying or ignoring slavery were evil, and it was the moral duty of the United States to eliminate the evil of slavery. Garrison did not really begin to use his genius again for anti-racism in declaring that racial disparities were evil and that those racists justifying or ignoring disparities were evil and that it was the moral duty of the United States to eliminate the evil of racial disparities. He was too bogged down by the assimilationist idea that black people needed to be developed, that oppression had made black people inferior. And nearly every assimilationist inside and outside of racial justice movements have similarly been bogged down by this idea that part of what we need to do is basically develop black people as a group because of the effects of poverty or segregation or slavery, that we can't principally as a society, as a racial justice community, focus on racial discrimination. We can't simply create equal opportunities and equal resources because black people still won't thrive, right? That has been the idea. So then people have basically spent some of their racial justice energy trying to tutor and develop black people based on this idea that something was wrong with them as a group. And that, of course, suggests that black people are problem people. And we know that over a century ago, Du Bois asked, how does it feel to be a problem? Right? And we've had many different sort of answers to that. You've had people who understand themselves as racial reformers trying to solve the problem of black people. And then you've had segregationists saying that they can't be solved. They are permanently like that. Inequality is permanent. While no, assimilationists have said, no, it's going to take some time, but we can do it, which is really the basis of this notion of gradual equality. While anti-racists have said, there's nothing wrong with these people, right? The only thing that's wrong with black people is they think something is wrong with black people. Or the only thing that's extraordinary about white people is they think something is extraordinary about white people. So what we need to do actually is focus on eliminating racial inequality and figuring out those policies that are generating that inequality. And so in closing, you know, I should say that I actually was in many ways changed by this book. Not only did I realize the way in which racial reformers who identify as assimilationists, like Garrison, were partially in sort of this force of progressive racial change by challenging slavery, while simultaneously when it came to these people as people, they were rendering them inferior. Not only was that sort of complex sort of set of ideas for assimilationists and actions, but I also realized through writing this book that the way we understand the roots of racist ideas, the causes of racist ideas, are actually not true. So I actually thought, going into this text, that these thinkers that I chronicled were just ignorant and hateful. And I thought that I would just sort of chronicle their racist ideas. I thought that it was these racist ideas that these people had that caused them to institute policies that Garrison challenged, like slavery, or even segregation, or even now mass incarceration, that it was really ignorance leading to racist ideas and racist ideas leading to racist policies. But I actually found that it was quite the opposite. And I ended up studying in Stanford in the beginning what I call the producers of racist ideas and distinguished them from the consumers. And I tried to understand why they were creating these ideas at that time. And in sort of contextualizing them within their historical moment and investigating the motives behind the creation of their ideas, why did John C. Calhoun in 1837 stand up before his colleagues in the U.S. Senate and say, slavery is a positive good? What was happening? Well, there were people like William Lloyd Garrison who had taken terms like slavery was a necessary evil, which came out of Jefferson's work, to saying slavery was an unnecessary evil. And the abolitionist movement that he was leading was rendering slavery evil in more and more minds across this country. And so you had slaveholders who felt threatened, and the king, the intellectual king of slaveholders, was John C. Calhoun. And John C. Calhoun pulled from an old text that was written in the 18 teens that described slavery as a positive good and brought it back into the mainstream to defend against slavery, created this idea of slavery as being a positive good, right? And then that idea, that racist idea, circulated, and then people started believing that slavery was good for black people. Slavery was civilizing black people, right? And that idea carried on into Jim Crow historiography, which, of course, caused more well-meaning historians to say, no, slavery was actually made these people into barbarians. I'm saying this all to say that actually it was racist policies and the self-interest behind racist policies that was actually causing and leading to the production of racist ideas. And the circulation and even consumption of racist ideas is what actually was leading to people to become ignorant and hateful. If we break down sort of the function of racism in its most basic sense, this country from its beginning has had racial inequality. And there's only two explanations for any sort of racial inequality, any sort of inequality between any two groups. Either there's something wrong or inferior about the group that is on the low end of the inequality, and there's something right and superior about the group that's on the higher end, or discrimination. And so what racist ideas do is it causes you and I to think that that inequality that is persisting, that is in our face, is Black people's fault. And it's certainly not the fault of discriminators and racist policies. And so those who are benefiting from those policies are allowed to continue to benefit from those policies, because we then spend our time, or part of our time, as Garrison did, thinking that we had to save or civilize or incarcerate Black people. And so again, that's really the story that I tell. It's a quite a complicated story. But it shows us that really the roots of this problem is not a sort of a moral or even an ignorance problem. It's a problem of power. And so those who are engaged in racial justice work, those who are truly trying to eliminate inequality, you're going to have to challenge the policies that create them and the power behind those policies. And the only way you can do that, historically, the way people have done that is through social movements, protest movements, or getting into positions of power. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. We are now open for questions. And Professor Farmer?
I've been doing a lot of reading on Frederick Douglass lately, mm-hmm. and wonder if you have any insights that you'd like to discuss on his relationship with Garrison, particularly with his publication of The North Star.
Sure. So one of the theories, and I would classify as racist theories, of assimilationists historically, and typically those who are very well-meaning and are truly trying to end the racial problem as they see it, whether that racial problem is slavery, segregation, or even Black people. One of the ideas that they have been put forth is this idea that they need to lead that struggle. That Black people cannot lead that struggle. And there actually was this famous dispute between Garrison and Frederick Douglass over this very issue, in which Garrison suggested, and I could quote him directly if I had my book, suggested that basically the people who were being subjected to the oppression cannot really take a step back and see the problems and be the ones who are the leaders of a solution. And of course, Frederick Douglass, that was a shot at Frederick Douglass. And of course, Frederick Douglass did not take too kindly to that. But of course, you know, before that, they, you know, had a really good relationship. I mean, Frederick Douglass largely viewed Garrison, you know, as a mentor. Garrison was very responsible for, he was one of the people who felt it would be necessary for Black people to actually go on the road and speak out about abolitionism. And so they have a really complicated relationship. Even that dispute, I mean, they were able to a certain extent make up after that. Harriet Beecher Stowe got in the middle of them and basically compelled them to sort of make up. But it's a very complicated relationship. But I do think that, and I chronicle this in the book, that Garrison was wrong in suggesting that white people needed to lead the abolitionist movement.
Hi, Dr. Kendi. I'm really glad you wrote your book. I feel like I was waiting all my life to read it. I had a question in mind, but it kind of changed just when you said that, as you wrote it, you noticed a change in yourself mm-hmm. from writing about evil ideas and to seeing it as something different. But who was your audience as you wrote it? Like, what was your, thoughts as you were writing it? Who were you thinking of as your readers?
So that's a great question. I think it changed multiple times throughout writing the book. I think during the process of producing the book. I think when I began my research, I considered that my audience would be open-minded white Americans, and as well as scholars of Black life. But by the time I ended my research, I knew that Black people were just as likely to produce, not just as like, Black people had produced and consumed racist ideas over the course of American history, just as white people had. And that they, of course, could gain from reading this book too and interrogate their own ideas about Black people, just as anyone else would be interrogating. And so really, on some level, I think by the end of my research, I would have probably say no one, like those who have racist ideas but are open-minded, are my audience. I do think that this book can be quite effective in any community, even including the Black community, because it, typically these racist ideas, I would argue, have principally targeted Black minds to make Black people think that they should be enslaved, that they should be poor, that they should be incarcerated, that they are actually achieving at a lower level than white kids. All of these ideas, so they won't resist this society that is sort of barricading them. We know slave owners did that, right? We wanted the slaves to believe that they should be enslaved, but that carried on even after the end of slavery. Yes.
After really going through this book, I thought about the questions I wanted to ask, and so there are just two. What really motivates you to produce the work that you do? Because I'm in grad school right now, getting a master's in history at Simmons College down the road, and so you go through those times where start getting a little, start to lack confidence and such like that. So really, at the end of the day, what really motivates you to produce the work that you do? And then also a fun question. If you could resurrect five people from the past historically and have a five-course meal with them and talk about anything, who would they be and why?
So I heard our president is all-powerful. He's already resurrected Frederick Douglass, right? So I guess I don't have to do that. So after Frederick Douglass, since, again, he's already resurrected, I would probably say Zora Neale Hurston, Audre Lorde, Malcolm X, Maria Stewart, mm-hmm. and of course Du Bois. Awesome. And the first question, what motivates me is, I think I was really born and bred in Black spaces, from going to Black schools, Black churches, HBCU, the best in the land, getting 3 degrees in African American studies. I think I, through sort of coming of age in all of these Black spaces, was able to really get a sense of the diversity of black people. What I mean by diversity is the beauty and the ugliness of Black people, a beauty and ugliness that renders Black people imperfectly equal to other groups. And, simultaneously, falling in love with Black people and falling in love with all people because, I was able to sort of learn and see the humanity of Black people, right? So if you love any group of people, you love humanity. And so I think that's really what sort of drives me, to give Black people an equal set at security and love and liveliness in this nation, and partnering with people who are trying to do the same thing for poor people and for women and the LGBT community and immigrants and every other group of people who are rendered inferior to justify policies against them.
Hi there. Just right before coming to your talk, I was reading about Foucauldian discourse analysis, and it seems pretty apropos given that a lot of your work is essentially saying that the way that we talk about these things, the terms that we use in thinking about them, are inherently informing the conclusions that we're drawing from them, if I understand your argument correctly. And I think that's a terrific argument, and what it touches to is the fact that our consciousness as Americans is inherently a product of this language, and that our notions of equality, parity, all of those things are informed by the terms that we employ when discussing them. And you've exposed a pretty considerable flaw in the way that we talk about these things. And my question to you would be, how do you overcome that? How do you compensate for that kind of linguistic gap that leads you to the wrong conclusions and leads you to adopting, as you said, these ideas that then perpetuate these policies that then further perpetuate these ideas and leave us trapped almost in these boundaries that we're not even conscious of almost?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for that question. And that's actually what I've been thinking a lot about, because I've been receiving that question quite a bit. And as it relates to race, I would say that really, instead of us being engaged in this sort of fallacious task of not being racist, instead we should focus on becoming an anti-racist. And that's why I like the title of my next book is How to Be an Anti-Racist. And because if we have, you know, how to cook manuals or how to drive, why not how to be an anti-racist, right? No, seriously. But seriously, you know, I think, you know, so for me, that's why I said earlier, this very simple idea that the racial groups are equal. It's a very simple anti-racist idea. But when you apply that, right, what that means is that if there are disparities, that it must be the result of a policy or a discriminatory policy, right? And so then it allows us, whenever we have these disparities and inequities in any sector of society, again, it's either something wrong with people, or there's something wrong with the policy. And, you know, we've been led to believe hundreds of years in racial and non-racial matters that there's something wrong with people. And so I would sort of suggest our efforts should be focused on more being an anti-racist. So understanding what it means, as scientists told us, to know that there's no genetic differences between the racial groups. That's scientifically inappropriate. And if anything, scholars have found that within the continent of Africa, the people in Africa are more genetically different than they are from people in other groups. And then for us to embrace what it truly means to believe in cultural relativity, which is the notion that every culture should be judged from its own standards. And not just every culture in a sort of macro sense, not just African-American culture broadly, but within African-American culture, there are many different cultures from a class standpoint, a regional standpoint, a gendered standpoint. And so we oftentimes like to, you know, look at our culture and sort of judge others. And Black elites normally do this. Black Northerners think Southern Black culture is inferior. I mean, you know, and so on and so forth. For us to recognize that not only are we culturally equal despite differences, but behaviorally equal. Right. One of the things that scholars have sought to do is try to figure out a way to prove that Black people are more lazy or criminal-like, or all of these other traits, and they've never been able to do so. Right. And I've chronicled nearly 500 years of people trying to make these cases, and they've always used misleading statistics or subjective standards to render Black people behaviorally inferior. And then after that, it becomes even more tricky, because we have to develop more of an intersectional anti-racism, which basically means that you know, black people are a collection of racial groups. And so from a gendered perspective, you know, you have black women and black men and even black people who don't identify as having a gender. You have, from a class perspective, you have multiple black classes. And within this, you have people who view their racial group, like black men view themselves as superior to black women, and replicate the same ideas about black women that white men and white women say. But then they somehow think that those ideas are not racist, right? And so it's for us to not only view our all of these racial groups as equal. And so it becomes very sort of complex. You know, that simple idea that the racial groups are equal actually is quite complex.
All righty. I've seen that you've gone to multiple HBCUs, and then also being a product of one. Obviously, you know, previously you spoke about being open-minded about, you know, particular ideas in your book, and one of them being that black people can be racist, right? Mm-hmm. I heard it first on your New Books in African American Studies podcast, and I was struck like, I don't know how I feel about that, right? And so opening up my mind, I started to think as I started to read the book, like, what you were saying before, like, have I been in areas of Tallahassee, to give an example, or I live in Dorchester now, which is much, much different than being over here. And I started to think that, oh, snap, he ain't lying about, you know, holding these particular possible pathologies about black and brown communities. And so my question really is, has there been a particular pushback? Because I've even earlier today seeing a meme, you know, talking about, oh, when a, you know, when someone says another black person can be racist. Okay. Has there been a particular pushback about that particular idea? Because I know for a fact that there is still, I guess within the parameters of your definitions, that they might not necessarily say that your definition, though I do, is necessarily valid.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm.
So thank you so much for that question. There has been pushback for two reasons. First, one is very personal, in which, of course, as you would imagine, black people who think there's something inferior about black people do not want those ideas to be rendered racist. I mean, in their mind, they're true. Just like slaveholders thought it was true and segregationists thought their ideas were true and so on and so forth. The other part is ideological. And so it's coming from this theory that black people can't be racist because black people don't have power. And it's coming from this definition of racism of prejudice plus power. And black people can't be racist because, you know. What's problematic about that is I think most people, especially young people, don't understand that that sort of idea came about in result of struggle. What I'm talking about is, you know, actually, one of the things I study is the Black Power movement. And Black Power activists from the beginning, Stokely Carmichael within weeks was being called a racist, right? And we know the ways in which Black Lives Matter activists have been called racist, right? And so the response, the reaction, you know, to that, especially during the Black Power movement, in a general sense, was black people can't be racist because black people don't have power. And that's what we're striving, of course, to get. The problem with that reaction to the reaction was that it simply was not true. So black people as individuals have power. In other words, power is a very relative concept. To say that no black people have power is to say that not a single black person right now in this country can just basically not hire a black person because they're black. Like, I'm sure there are many black people in this country who have the power to hire and fire. There are many black people in this country who have the power to execute or eliminate policies that discriminate against black people. And so I think we need to recognize that. And in recognizing that, we'll see that some of these people are discriminating against black people and therefore in defending their discrimination with racist ideas. And then what we will also see is what white supremacists have done to ensure the progression of racism or the continuation of these racist policies, which is I will put a black person in a position of power who's going to execute the same racist policies and defend them with the same racist ideas. And then we can't challenge that person as being racist because what? Black people don't have what? Black people can't be what? Racist. I think it's really handicapped the racial justice movement, this idea. Another thing I'll say is that it doesn't allow us to understand the critical function of racist ideas historically. And again, I stated earlier, the critical function of racist ideas is not to offend people. The critical function of racist ideas is to justify inequality, which then allows and causes people to not challenge that racially discriminatory policy that creates that inequality. So in other words, if I've been led to believe as a black person that black people should be enslaved, I am not going to challenge the policies of enslavement. If I've been led to believe that black people are reckless with the police, as many black people, I shouldn't say many, as some black people have said, right, defending the actions of the police and saying Blue Lives Matter, then I'm clearly not going to challenge those policies that is actually causing a war against black lives, just like those white people and other groups of people who are not doing that too. And then what happens? Those policies continue, and they then continue to harm black people, and racist ideas continue to function superbly, which is precisely what they're intended to do.
Well, I have to thank Professor Kendi very much. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by University of Florida Assistant Professor of African American History, Ibram X. Kendi. Professor Kendi's lecture was titled Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor of African American Studies and History, Linda Haywood. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.